Good morning, everybody, ladies and gentlemen, and children of all ages. Just for fun, I love this. If there was no rear wall in the classrooms in which I teach, my students would be sitting in the next county. And I've never figured out why the front environment for no man has gone before. How many people were in the last session I just gave? Now, I just want to let you know, talking about marriages, that my wife despised this title that I made up. She thought it was terrible. I kind of thought it was cute. Marriages, united or untied, it depends where you put the I. Well, I flew in this morning on Untied Airlines, but we came in about 5 hours late, so we actually got to bed about 4:30 this morning, and thank goodness for the 12 cups of Coca-Cola that I had before starting up here. Okay. I'd like to tell you a little bit. I'm just sorry for this review, as the Chazar is never bad. I just want to tell you a bit about what I am, who I do, where I do, how I do, why I do, etc. Either impress or depress, you would just let you know where I'm coming from in terms of talking about marriages. My wife and I started dating, and she said if our kids had ever did this, she'd kill them. We dated for 7 years, but she was only 15. We started dating. We've been married for 28 years. So I'm trying to draw on some personal experiences here. Also, in addition to the psychological psychobabble that I'll be using, but I hate psychobabble, so I'll translate everything into English for you as we go along. Some of my students call me Dr. Krug, some of them call me Rabbi Krug, some of them call me things I can't say in public, and they believe it. And I am the dean of a yeshiva high school, a co-educational yeshiva high school located in Paramus, New Jersey, with 650 students. I talk too fast. By the way, anybody here in education is going, oh, good. Some interesting research. The average teenager, when they don't have to think, can listen to about 400 words a minute. When they do have to think, they can only deal between about 150 to 200 words a minute, and the average teacher talks to 250 words per minute, which means the average teacher is talking at twice the speed at which the average teenager is capable of listening and understanding, and I'm moving on about 500 words a minute right now. I'll slow down, don't worry. So I'm the dean of Yeshiva High School. I have 650 grades 9 through 12. I'm also a professor of Yeshiva University and two of the graduate schools, the undergraduate school of education and the graduate school for the rabbinical students. And I'm also a clinical psychologist in private practice. I work mostly, very bizarre because of my background, I work mostly with Holocaust survivors and professional actors, which sounds very strange, but that's my clientele. And I also work in professional theater. For 29 years, I was assistant producer of a show called The Fantastics, which was off-Broadway. And I've done about 250 production credits on Broadway, off-Broadway, summer stock, national touring companies, and stuff like that. No matter what, we're leaving the front row empty. Now, I could impress you by doing up my tie and putting my jacket on, but just take it off and undo it, so, okay. I'm going to be talking about marriages. And the first concept, and whenever I give concepts psychologically, I try and give practical examples. I give the practical examples, which are much more important. So, for those of you, I don't know how many of you have this nice little sheet here that you can take notes on, stuff like that, but I'm going to actually try and follow the outline. And one of the first times in my life, I cut my outlines down and actually got through most of the outline in the last presentation. Psychology of energy and the energy of psychology. That's topic number one. What do you mean? I'll tell you what I mean. It's a good question. I'm glad you asked. It shows you're interested. Keep the enthusiasm rolling. Every one of us is born with a certain amount of psychological energy necessary for life. We have these gas tanks. Now, some people have bigger gas tanks, some people have lower gas tanks, but we all have this gas tank full of psychological energy necessary for life. And in addition to physical energy, which is required for anything that we do, we require psychological energy as well. Well, when I give of myself to somebody else, hence the connection to marriage, when I give of myself to somebody else, I am using up my psychological energy. And as I give, my energy level goes down. As I give, my energy level goes down, 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 down. If I give, my energy level goes down, 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 down. Because I'm using up my psychological energy necessary for life. What do you mean give? Well, I'm walking down the hall, there's a guy behind me, and I hold the door open for him. I have paused in my existence to do something for somebody else. I might not even know who that somebody else is. And he walks through the door. I've given it myself. I'm driving down 294, a lot of traffic there. The guy trying to get in, he can't get in. I slow down, I flash my bright lights, and I say, please enter, essentially. I've given it myself to another driver. No idea who the guy is. Little 4-year-old kid wants to make a surprise for mommy before she comes home, so he runs around the house and he tidies up, so when mommy comes in, it'll be all tidy, it's a big huge amount of psychological energy going into that. Boyfriend picking up the telephone to call girlfriend. The physical act of reaching for the phones and dialing the numbers. is an investment of psychological energy. Saying to somebody, I love you, for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons, we'll get to the wrong reasons later, but saying to somebody, I love you, for the right reasons, you think back to the first time you heard it from the person who is your soulmate, major investment of psychological energies, you pour those three words out, okay? So by giving, it's going to go down. That's a problem. Why? Because I come down towards something called a critical level. This boundary here. I need this much to keep me going. I need this much to keep myself, two words, the self that is me. I need this much to keep myself alive. And as I come down and I approach the critical level, all of a sudden the warning lights go off. Cease giving, do not give anymore, because you know inherently that as you're coming down, you're getting dangerously close to this critical level. And you cannot afford, God forbid, to dip below this critical level because terrible things happen, terrible things. People become suicidal, depression, psychotic breakdowns. Your mind is going on a one-way trip to Mars. Terrible things happen if you drift below this critical level. However, there's a wonderful corollary here. And that is, if I give of myself and I get back in return, my energy level goes higher than it originally was. What do I mean? Let me see if I can remember my examples. Okay, I'm holding the door open for this guy. Walks through, doesn't say a thing. Should I go into depression? Should I crawl into bed for the day? Of course not. But I've given off a tiny little piece of myself that's gone. Or the guy walks through and goes, thanks a lot, buddy. Thanks a lot, buddy. Four words. That's the return on my investment. Okay. It's a return on my investment. I've gotten my investment back. By driving, right? I flash my bright lights and say to the guy, come on in. And he comes in and drives off without a thing. I say to myself, I'm really an idiot, never should have let him in. Or he gives me a little wave in the rearview mirror. It's not even a verbal exchange, it's what's called an emblem or a gesture. A little wave in the rearview mirror, it's a return on my investment. Little four-year-old kid who's run around to make a surprise for mommy, and mommy comes in and doesn't even notice, and the kid is down. Mommy comes in and says, you're such a honey, tidied up, come here, let me give you a hug. Kid's flying, like $1 million, he's just sailing. Huge return on huge investment. Boyfriend picks up telephone to go girlfriend, gets a busy signal, picks up, dials. There's now an emotional reaction to this plastic device called a telephone. Anger, who's she on the phone with? Fear, who's she on the phone with? We have this emotional reaction to this plastic device because of this give and take. Saying to somebody, I love you for the right reasons and having it accepted, you're flying. Having it rejected, your little pieces all over the place. They're going to come sweep you up or scrape you off with a spatula and try to put you back together again. This concept has huge, giant implications for us, particularly in marriage, obviously, because that's where the exchanges take place. Every now and then, most human beings, most marriages, spend their lives going up and down like a thermometer. Goes up, goes down. Every now and then, you're going to come across a couple that's just sailing through life. And you look at them and you wonder, how did they do that? They're just sailing. And the answer to that is because their relationship is set up that it's give and take and give and take. Not like the old vaudeville joke, yeah, my marriage is give and take, my wife takes 50%, I give 50%. No. The whole relationship is give and take. And there's no limit to how high you can go. There is a limit to how low you can go, which is this critical level. No limit to how high you can go. And every now and then you're going to come across this couple that's just sailing through life. They're just flying through life. Huge, giant implications. I don't know how many of you have ever come across the following. Grandpa, grandma, been married for 50 years. One day, grandpa dies, and 3 months later, grandma's dead too, and she was never sick a day in her life. I don't know how many of you have ever come across that. What do you have? You have a half century of people being together, and you rip half the system away, and all of a sudden, it's like a cold front coming through, and there's no way to stop it, there's no way to check it, there's no way to keep it from dropping, it just slides. And one day it slithers below this critical level, and the death certificate, yes, may say arteriosclerosis or heart attack or stroke or pneumonia or something else. The psychological literature says that what I'm presenting to you now is an incredibly powerful, powerful energy source and energy field in us as human beings, and particularly as it relates to marriages. So I'm going to put that on the shelf right now as one piece. I'm not going to spend a long time reviewing something I did in the last segment called Satellization. But basically what I said in less than 2 minutes, what I said and developed in the last session was, when kids are born, they have at the center of the universe mommy and daddy. And then they move away from mommy and daddy being the center of the universe, and they move into the peer group as being the center of the universe. And as you go through teenagedom, towards the end of teenagedom, you begin to pull away from the peer group. You're floating around looking for something to make the center of your universe. There's another being out there, and you two guys find each other, and your lives begin revolving around each other. And in resatellization, which is the final stage, two human beings whose lives are at the center of each other's universe begin the system all over again with their own kids. One of the problems that is being found today for all kinds of reasons is that, I'm not talking to anybody here. Do not leave here going, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed, talk about me the whole time. No, I'm not doing that, okay? Sometimes I'm talking to myself. Most adults in this country never achieve adulthood. It's okay. We have a very long adolescence in this country. Longer than in any other period in history, longer than any place else in the world. Adolescence in the United States runs from about age 11 into the early 20s. It's a huge long adolescence for all kinds of reasons, some of them economic, some of them educational. What our kids are thinking about at the age of 17 is the year in Israel, where am I going to college? You go to Israel, 17-year-old thinking about where am I going for army next year. It's a whole different mindset. We have the longest adolescence of any known culture. So it's okay to be a 15-year-old adolescent and an 18-year-old adolescent and even a 22-year-old adolescent. The problem in life comes when you have a 35 and a 45 and a 55-year-old adolescent, where you have a 16-year-old packed into a 55-year-old body. That becomes problematic because adolescents cannot maintain long-term relationships. One of the reasons for the rising untied, the rising divorce rate, and I'll give you some statistics for the Jewish community in just a second, is the fact that we never make it to full adulthood. Why not? Because we're mitigated against getting there. The world is pulling us away from being full-fledged adults. Being adult doesn't mean you can't have fun. Being adult doesn't mean you can't pick up your wife and toss her out in the middle of a snowstorm and have a snow fight with each other. That's not what I mean. I'm talking about areas of responsibility and a serious and mature grabbing of life by the horns and charting a course with a soulmate and you get out in the high seas because you are heading in a direction. Yeah, the big man upstairs is going to bill you and blow you about with your boat on that water, but you have an idea where you two captains are going to sail that boat together into the future because you've bothered working it out. You have no idea how many couples I sit with. I do a lot of premarital counseling as well for rabbis. Rabbis will call me and say, listen, I'm supposed to be going to start a kedusha in a couple of weeks. Can you look at this couple? And I'm supposed to look at a couple and tell this rabbi the prognostic indicators associated with this relationship. And the answer is, yes, I can. And I'm going to give you all those secrets today without you having to pay $45,000 to go to graduate school. Okay, you'll get that? Stay tuned. Stay tuned. There's a recording up here. I'm not talking to the podium. You will get that in the next 15 minutes. Okay? So, we've got the energy theory here. And we've got this theory associated with you never achieve full-fledged adulthood. You're stuck at adolescence. And adolescents have a lot of trouble maintaining relationships that are meaningful, fulfilling, lasting, and long-term. And that's one of the things that we're going to go to the difference between tied and untied. Population in general is running a 54% divorce rate right now, which means that better than, or perhaps worse than, one out of every two marriages will end in a divorce relatively quickly. When I say relatively quickly, 18 to 36 months. In the Orthodox Jewish community, it has been climbing steadily. It is sitting at about 8.5% now. The 8.5% compared to 54% sounds great because of that number differential. But if you look, for example, at a school like mine, where I have 650 kids in the school, and all of a sudden 50-something of them come from broken homes, you're really looking at a pretty heavy critical mass of people that are coming out of broken homes. And what does that mean? And the big question is, how did they get there? What happened from the day that two people stood under a chuppah and they went through Erusin and Nesumin, Kedushin, and they swore they were going to be together forever. And forever is a long time. And all of a sudden, it unraveled. How did it get there? How did that happen? We're going to try and tackle some of those questions over the next, I can't believe this, in 45 minutes, I'm supposed to talk about how to keep, yeah, it's going to be a little bit of a challenge here. Okay, but we're going to try and give you, and I'm going to try and share with you some of what I try to pick up in my own life, part of the tools for doing this, for keeping it going. All right, I'm going to present the theory right now. I have the theory of energy, and the theory of this, like, you know, being the center of people's universe. Another theory, I'm actually charging through here on number three. It's called facade. Facade was a term that was supposedly coined by Freud, but it really wasn't coined by Freud. I'll tell you what I mean by that. You all know the signs for drama. There's this happy guy and a sad guy, these masks. You know, okay. Those are called Greek facades. And a facade is a mask. And in Greek theater, anybody study theater, they did not show emotion on the stage in Greek theater for two reasons. One is they had these huge stadiums. They were acoustical, brilliant engineers. If you ever go to a place like Beit Shan, where you had the stadium in the archaeological digs, you had 10,000 people sitting there, and if you stand on this, no microphones, you stand on the stage, you talk, everybody can hear you. The sound is unbelievable. But if you're sitting way up here, you can't see the face. You have to hold up a mask to show the emotion. Plus, it was part of the philosophy of Greek theory to use these masks. Happy mask, angry mask, sad mask. You can see these masks if you go into the Israel Museum where they are unearthing them. There are 27 archaeological digs in Israel and Jordan. I think 14 of them are on the west side of the Jordan, the rest on the east side of the Jordan, where they're digging up these Greek theaters. They have these facades. As a matter of fact, in modern cinematography, the word facade is also interesting. The word facade, I don't know how many of you have ever been to like California or Florida, MGM, Universal Studios, or whatever, and they have what's called the backlots. You can have New York scene of the streets in 1964, Chicago in the 1930s, a Mexican hacienda, a moonscape, the Sahara Desert. You have all these backlot sets, and you can be standing there, and you feel like you're in Chicago in the 1930s, because you've got all these beautiful fronts of buildings. There's nothing behind them. You've got all these beautiful fronts of buildings. They're called facades in modern cinematography. Well, along comes Sigmund Freud and says the following. He says, we all have facades. We have these masks, and we have to have these masks because the world is throwing arrows of outrageous fortune in our direction, but you can't hurt me, ha, 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 because I have my mask on. So you have your mask, and you have to have your mask. You're supposed to have your mask, and you go through life with this mask. And all of a sudden, you find another human being, and you're intrigued by them. There's something about them that touches you. But you've got a problem because you're wearing a mask, and they're wearing a mask, and you know they're wearing a mask, and they know you're wearing a mask. So what do? You kind of like enter this subconscious contract. You basically say to them, you're wearing a mask and I'm wearing a mask. I'll tell you what, I'll move my mask just a little bit if you move your mask just a little bit. And if I like what I see and you like what you see, I'll move my mask a little bit more and you move your mask a little more. And if I really, really like what I see, I'll risk it. I'll take my mask off. I'll show you who I really am. That's dangerous. Why? Because once you take this mask off, you're vulnerable. There's no more any protection, and someone can come in and stab, and it hurts. And if anybody here has ever been hurt by a friend or somebody that you felt you could trust, and you dropped that mask, and they hurt you, and you can feel the physical dimensions of that emotional pain. Your heart feels heavy. Your stomach feels like it's tied up in knots. You got a lead weight hanging in your belly. You can feel the physical aspects of this emotional hurt. What is the remedy, the first aid for that? Up goes the mask again. Ha ha, can't hurt me anymore. And you go on to your next encounter. Maybe your next encounter, you're not so quick to move the mask. And maybe you've been hurt too many times, either in the context of a relationship or before. You had in the context of a marriage or before the marriage took place, you've been hurt too many times, you're not going to drop that mask. You're going to keep that mask in place. And some people go through lives with these thick, immovable masks. That's a problem. Well, A, it's a problem because it's thick. Two, it's a problem because it's immovable. Three, it's a problem because sometimes there's nothing behind the mask in the first place. And somewhere, someday, somehow, something can come and rip that mask away from you, and all of a sudden you discover one day there's no essence to your being. I told a story in the first session about this actor who discovered that one day. It was a patient of mine. It's very frightening to wake up and discover there's no you, that your whole life has just been an act because you've been in costume with this mask. Two masks cannot stay married for any length of time. You can fumfer their way around a little bit, and they can kind of joust and do a fancy footwork in the ring, but the wondrous aspects of what a marriage is supposed to be, they'll never attain. And marriages are wondrous and wonderful, because what happens and the philosophy of marriage and Jewish thought. First of all, we use the word kiddushin to describe it. It's kadosh, it is holy. Why is, if you look at the things that are called in Jewish law, yaharog ba'al yavor, the things that you should let yourself be killed rather than commit the sin. If somebody comes up to you and pulls a gun and goes, you eat this bacon sandwich, I blow your head off. You go past the mustard and down it. But somebody comes and says you commit adultery, you let yourself be killed rather than commit adultery, because anything that attacks the nuclear family in Jewish thought is the most heinous thing that you could possibly conceive of. Anything that sabotages or uproots the Jewish family is horrible. It's built into, it's kiddushin. You engage in an element of kiddusha when two minds, and I'm saying this purposely, yes, we're all adults, okay, good. When two minds and two souls and two hearts come together and two bodies, and in that moment of culmination, they sometimes actually produce a physical manifestation of their love, which is a child. What's a child in Jewish thought? A child in Jewish thought is a physical creation of the love the love expressed by two human beings with God as one of the partners, says the Gemara. There are three partners in the creation of every being. There's a mother, there's a father, and there's God. And the philosophy of this is so powerful. There's no word for the female human sexual organ. It's called makom. Hey, makom, it's also one of God's names. It's very powerful what exists in Jewish thought is what a marriage is supposed to be, the bonding and binding of these human beings. By the way, when we have a chasam and kala, and I haven't gotten yet to how you tell you're in love, we'll get to that. When you have a chasam and kala, what do you wish for them in the brachos? That they be re'im ha'ahuvim. It's the highest blessing you can get. Now, one of the things we're not bothered by is like where do words come from. There are lots of words to describe relationships. You did. That's a nice word to describe. You know, dear ones. Chaver, friend. And then you have re'im, as in yahafta l're'acha kamocha, love your neighbors, yourself. So, the root of yadid, say some, it's spelled yud-dalad, yud-dalad. Two hands, yad is a hand. Two hands reaching out. They can become yididim, okay? Chaver, the source, the root of the word friend is michubar, which means connected. I took thing A, I took thing B, and I got some crazy glue, and I brought them together. That's what a chaver is. Mechubar means connected. So you can't write a get, for example. Sometimes mechubar lakarka is connected to the ground. You can't have sat, that's mechubar. Chaver, mechubar, same thing. What's the shorish of the word re'im, reish ayin? It means bad. Right. Yeah, that's true. Simchon Fall Hirsch is the only one who says this. He says it comes from a shepherd. Everybody else says it's a concept that's based from the Zohar. Where something was always one, it transcends time, and there are different facets to it, but it was always one. Re'im ho'ahuvim. I didn't take thing A and thing B and bring them together. These souls have been bound and bonded from time immemorial and will be after this world as well. They're always one. Yeah, there are different facets to them, but they're connected. That's the how the word reish ayin got to be bad is a whole separate class. But that's what the source of the word Re'im Ha'avim is. It's the highest level that you can attain. I'm going to talk about that in number four in a second and tie it up to some modern theorists. I'm going to jump over to number five, which is very important. This is part of the way that you can look at the health of your relationship. If your relationship is a bell and you bang it, does it go ding with a nice sound or does it go clank? Okay, how can you tell? When a rabbi calls me and says, Johnny, I'd like you to take a look at this couple. I'm supposed to be a Seder Kiddush. I don't know that they have such a hot relationship. So what do I look for? Okay? Couple things. I'll give you some examples. I was with a couple a couple of weeks ago, and there was a chasan and kala in my office. And I said to the kala, what do you like about your chasan? And she reels off this whole long list of stuff. Very nice. Okay, good. And I look at the chasan and I say, what do you like about your kala? I'm like, that, he says, she makes me feel so good. And I think to myself, interesting. Okay, you didn't answer my question. Okay, so I go, okay, that's really good. Yeah, really cool. Yeah, that's good. Right. I sometimes model my psychology after Bill Cosby. My two role models in psychology are Bill Cosby and Jackie Mason. Okay. So I say, I try again. I go to the class and I say, it's good. I'm glad she makes you feel. What do you like about her? And he thinks, he goes, when I'm with her, I feel so good. I'm thinking to myself, uh-oh, okay? Because every time we try and pull the spotlight here, he yanks it back there. There are too many I's, there are too many me's. Very narcissistic, very selfish. So I try again a third time. So what do you like? This is the person that you're going to walk hand in hand down the road of life with forever. What do you like about her? He says, I feel so good when I'm with her, and I think to myself, whoa, we got some troubles here. We got some problems. But what do you look for? I got a couple sitting in front of me who claim they're in love. How do you know they're in love? So there's no end-all and be-all to this, but one of the prognostic indicators, I forgot to do the following. Would you please turn all your cell phones off? Is this silent? Yes, it is. Okay, thank you. Nobody called anyway. Okay, good. Hi, wife. Okay. My wife. I love my wife. Actually, the best years of my life have been with my wife. 1987, 92, 96. No, the joke. Okay. Actually, I didn't say anything during the first 2 years of my marriage. I didn't have anything to say. I didn't want to interrupt my wife. It was very good. Okay. That goes back to those of you in the first session. Okay. What do you look for? They claim they're in love. Okay. So first of all, there's something called the stimulation value. What's a stimulation value? A stimulation value has zero, nothing whatsoever to do with anything physical, sexual, nothing like that. A stimulation value is, there's certain people, when you get into their presence, you just flick to a different level of functioning. You are more energized. You are more enthused. You are happier. The chemistry, the vibrance, the enthusiasm, the electricity is just flying when you're with these people. And when you're not, it's just not there. You get into their presence and your whole being moves into a different energy chamber, like I spoke about in the beginning. That's a stimulation value. Let me give you a couple of examples. I have a chavrusa that I learned with in Yerushalayim. A brilliant, brilliant, brilliant man. He's known, for those of you who know the name of Nevinsol in the Ir Atika, he's known in the Ir Atika as the young Rav Nevinsol. He's of that caliber. And I learn with him every Friday morning at 9 o'clock in the morning, his time, which is 2 a.m. my time. And it's very depressing for me to learn with this man, because I will prepare for hours, and I'll get on the phone, not because he does this, because I wish I had in my head what he has in his fingernails, and within the first 30 seconds after I prepared for hours, in the first 30 seconds, it's obvious I know nothing, okay? So, but it's a stimulation value. Now, my relationship with Rav Darmoni is 100% stimulation value. I don't need him for the two other things I'm going to describe. In a healthy relationship, in a healthy marriage, the three things, one of them being stimulation value, the three things I wanted to describe should float at about one-third each. It's a stimulation value. I work in professional theater. I get paid for working in professional theater. But I would pay for the honor of sitting at the feet of some of these creative giants and geniuses whose innovation and imagination and creativity and sensitivity and awareness are at such a magnificent peak. I'm standing there agape in gawking awe of their brilliance. That's a stimulation value. And again, some of these directors I work with, 100% of that relationship is stimulation value. That's fine. That's what it could be and should be for that. Not with my wife. Yeah, I should have a stimulation about with my wife. It should represent about one-third. What's the next thing? Next thing is called an ego support value. Ego support value is the old arm around the shoulder, I'll always be there for you no matter what type thing. You can have friends that are flatline dead on stimulation value and are 100% ego support value. It's okay to have friends like that. What you get from a spouse should be about one-third of that. One-third stimulation, one-third ego support. What's ego support? Two college roommates, okay? Years later, one lives in Washington, let's say, and one lives in the New York area. And they're going to talk, they call each other Pesach, they call each other Rosh Hashanah, maybe in the summer they see each other every now and then. And it's 15 years later, 20 years later, and the one in New York called the one in Washington and says, listen, I'm going to be okay. Don't worry. I'm going to be fine. I just didn't want you hearing this from somebody else. They found some stuff. I'm starting chemotherapy on Monday. Don't worry about me. I'm okay. Doctor says they caught it early, but I just didn't want you hearing from somebody else that I'm going through chemo. And you hang up the phone, and 4 hours and 10 minutes later, they knock at your door, and it's your old roommate.
And you know it's a four-hour drive from Washington to New York, so it must have taken him 10 minutes to throw his stuff into a suitcase and throw the suitcase into the trunk and hit the road. That's an ego support value. It's a very powerful, important piece of friendships. It's an even more powerful, important piece of a marriage. The last one is called utility value. Utility value is how people use each other for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons. The right reasons. Let me give you an example of a wrong reason. I'm best friends with my next door neighbor because he's an electrician and I need some electrical work done in my house, so we're best friends. That's a really bad utility value, okay? Bad utility value is because he earns a lot of money. Bad utility value, she wears very short skirts. These are not healthy utility values, okay? Utility value is, I want to know everything there is to know about you. Everything. I mentioned this last time. I want to know what makes you happy, what makes you sad, what makes you walk and talk and act, what your needs are, and what your morals are, and your values, and your ethics, and your ideals, and your attitudes, your dreams, your goals. I want to know what those needs are. I want to be the one to fulfill your needs. So you're really using me to fulfill your needs. But I'm using you to fulfill my needs also. There's a reciprocity there in a healthy utility value that is so important in a relationship. A healthy relationship that goes ding has all three of those elements present. And sometimes they need reviving. I said to somebody yesterday, I'm a little upset right now, I'll tell you why. Because I spent about 6 years of my life studying something called empty nest syndrome among Holocaust survivors, what I did my doctoral dissertation on. Empty nest syndrome is the depressive reaction the parents have when the last child leaves the home. And my theory at the time, I studied Holocaust survivor couples, was that Holocaust survivor couples would be much more prone to suffer a much more intense empty nest syndrome than the population at large. And indeed, I found that what I found in my study, which is mind-blowing, which I don't have time to go into now, but I'll tell you the reason I'm upset. Because this past September, my youngest child went to Israel to study for the year, and for the first time in 25 years, my wife and I are alone, and I'm thrilled. I just blew my entire doctoral thesis to kingdom come because there ain't no emptiness syndrome. Because we are getting to know each other. It's like dating all over again, and it's wonderful. Yeah, sometimes you need some rejuvenation because too many people put their relationships onto automatic pilot. And a relationship is like a fine flower, and it needs pruning, and it needs soil, and it needs water, and it needs sunshine, and it needs attention for it to grow properly. And too many relationships with couples that I meet are on automatic pilot. So we do need some spicing up in the stimulation value every now and then. It's absolutely true, but all three of those things should be present. Now, can a marriage survive without a stimulation value? The answer is yes. Boring. It is not exciting at all. You kind of trudge through life and go through the mundane and work the routine. And why should you be missing out? Okay? Can it survive without an ego support value? The answer is also yes. But a marriage without a stimulation value and without an ego support value is hanging by this slim thread, trailing in the wind, waiting to snap. Because the only thing holding it is utility value. Because I can get the ego support from somebody else. Now, some marriages, I'm not making any kind of prejudicial remark, some subcultures of society are plugged into having marriages like that. For those elements of subculture of society, it's fine. In Borough Park, for example, I'm generalizing, I'm stereotyping, and I hate people generalizing stereotype, but about the stereotype, you find the vibe of standing at the corner talking to each other with their baby carriages 9 months after they got married, while their husbands are in Kolo, their husband's talking to the Rebbe or whatever, because in that, the ego support value there comes from the wives to each other. It's a different subcultural value system. I'm not saying this negatively. I'm saying we need to look at ourselves and where you are, and where what you represent, and where your philosophy and theology and hashkafic stance is at. But in general, these three things, and I can find backup for every one of those things in Chazal. Chazal knew what they were doing. Each one of these, I'm not giving a shiur right now, can be found in Gemara. And then what kind of marriage do you have? Okay? That's number 6 on the list here. I think I have like 10 minutes to rummage through this. And I'll come back and tie it up with some thoughts and see if there's any questions before we go in for the panel.
Food. Before we go in for food, food is one of the greatest stimuli of all time. Psychologists call it a primary reinforcer. It's really good. By the way, any of you, I don't know if you have this here or not. By the way, I am your poster child for the adult version of the hyperactive child. I'm off on a tangent. I don't know if any of you have this in this show yet, but in my show, there's this wonderful thing called kiddish syndrome. Because, like, everybody sits at shul and shavs, right? And he gets to the end of the services, and the president gets up to make the announcements, and you're there, and you're like, yeah. And the president goes, And we'd like to wish Mr. and Mrs. Goldberg Mazel Tov and son Jason's bar mitzvah. And Mr. and Mrs. Goldberg are pleased to invite the entire congregation to a kiddush. And all of a sudden, bing! Woo-hoo! Right? You can feel this. You feel this tension building in the crowd, right? And then the little kid gets up to do Adon Olam. Yeah, but you, this tension is building here. And then as soon as shul is over, the men take off the talus like a toreador. Yeah! Right? Because it's going to be a kiddush. Right? And they get to the food. And everybody has their own way of like looking over the kiddush, right? Chop liver, 12 degrees! Right? And trying. And you take a plate. And you go. And you have this plate full of food. And you have this glass. And something very weird happens to us. Our bodies shrink. We go. Right? And you're walking like this. I'm not making this up, right? Because no, these poor people have not eaten in weeks. Right? And then you're standing like this. And first of all, you no longer have any neck movement. You're sure like this. You don't have any elbows. Your hands are like that. And somebody comes over and says, Shabbos, you have a problem. You're holding a cup. You're holding a plate. So you balance the cup at the edge of the plate. You know, Shabbos, you take it. And you sit down, right? So I don't know if you have this here or not, but Rachel, we're great at kiddush syndrome. Okay, food. Food is coming. Just hang in there, okay? Back to our regularly scheduled program. Okay. Marriages. What kind of marriage you got? Okay. I have something here. By the way, one of my favorites, I'll tell you about this one first. It's actually number 4 on the list. One of my favorites is something called a conflict habituated marriage. They're so funny to us therapists, okay? These are people who need each other to fight with. They fight about, they don't get divorced. They stay married, but they fight about everything. And the littlest thing turns into World War III, how the toast came out, or how the sponge is lying on the sink. So I was seeing this couple. This goes back about 6-7 months. This couple comes to me, and the first thing the husband says to me is, we never fight. And right away, I know he's either lying or they have no relationship. Because when you have a relationship, you fight. The question is, how do you fight? And how do you make up? And what are the rules of engagement for fighting? Any kids in here? Oh, good. No, I'll give you an example, okay? My wife and I have this rule. We stuck with this rule through 28 years of marriage so far. And that is, you don't fight in the bedroom. It's a rule that we have for ourselves. You don't fight in the bed. Bedroom is a place to make love, not war. We stuck with that rule. And the other rule we have is we never go to bed angry at each other. Right. And we do fight. People who are that close are going to get into disagreements with each other. So what do? One of two things. We either go downstairs to the living room to fight and work it out, or we're so dog tired that we drop the fight, but we'll not go to bed angry with each other. And we've never gone to bed angry at each other in all these years. Have people bothered working out these rules? So people who are married fight. You do fight, and you do come into disagreements. This couple comes in, and husband says, we never fight. So right away, yeah, right, okay? Now, what I'm about to tell you, it took 2 minutes to unfold in a classic example of a conflict-habituated relationship. Husband starts talking, and he's going. And the wife starts doing one of those things. What you really need to be a good family therapist, I teach my students, is phenomenal peripheral vision. Because while I'm watching the husband, I got a half an eye on the wife. And once you start getting these, like, eye-rolling things like, right? These are messages, man, right? And the wife who has like these half-shaded glasses that say aggression, right? And all of a sudden, you know, in the middle, she turns her chair this way, so her back's to her husband and crosses her legs in the opposite direction. These are all like wonderful, wonderful signs. So the husband's going on and on. He's talking about something, and he says, yeah, matter of fact, the other night I was at a party with my wife, and I was talking to an old friend of mine, and he stops talking to me. He says to his wife, she was the person in the maroon dress. He continues talking to me, and the wife goes, it was a red dress. The husband says, it was a maroon dress. And the wife says, it was a red dress. And the husband says, maroon. The wife says, I am not colorblind, it was red. That little hussy that you were off with in the corner talking was wearing a red. And they start yelling at each other. I am digging my nails into my desk so I don't burst out laughing. Because this happens within 2 minutes of his telling me that they never fight. By the way, it's really fun to be a therapist. I have to tell you that. I love it. I wonder if he's able to write a book about this. I actually have a, as I told you, I see comedy. Is this on? I'm off on a tangent. I'm off in the corner now. Okay, I was seeing somebody once, and this guy's a comedy writer, and he was like the nerdiest, wimpiest, dweebiest, geeky, this guy, the kind of guy you just want to like push down a flight of steps, you know, cause like, and he's telling me, he's dealing with his father, issues with his father, and he says to me, I made a little Freudian slip last night. I said, what happened? He goes, I was having dinner with my father, and I meant to say that, I'm having trouble keeping a straight face already during this discussion, right? I meant to say, Dad, would you please pass the salt? I'm thinking Freudian slip. Please pass Mom. I don't know, right? And what came out was, you lousy son of a bitch, you screwed up my whole life. Freudian slip? Right? I lost it. I could not keep it. So in this case, I didn't lose it. I was just digging my nails into the bottom of my desk to keep from laughing. Because this conflict-habituated marriage,
Peace.
Either I'm being dealt peace or I have 2 minutes to finish up. Whoa. Okay. Okay. Let me end up with something important. Okay. This talks about families. Rav Soloveitchik, my revered Rebbe Zatzal, once raised a very interesting question. He raised the question of why is Pirkei Avos called Pirkei Avos? Or Pirkei Avot. I was taught Ashkesvard when I was in school. Why is Pirkei Avos called Pirkei Avos? Ethics of the Fathers. Could have had a dozen other names. Pirkei Rabbanim, Pirkei Chachamim, Pirkei Zakenim, Pirkei Lomdim, Pirkei Melamdim, Ethics of the Rabbis, Ethics of the Elders, Ethics of the Wise. Why Pirkei Avos? And as was the Rav's want, he gave two answers. One of them textual in nature, and one of them powerfully psychological in nature. Said Rav Soloveitchik, the classic relationship between a teacher and student is as a parent to a child. And he points out that the example par excellence in Tanakh is Eliyahu and Elisha, Elijah and Elisha. And they are the paradigm for student-teacher relation. There's something very interesting. I mentioned last time, we don't teach our kids to read Tanakh dramatically. We should, because it's so powerful. Eliyahu's about to leave us. He doesn't die, he goes to Shemayim. He's about to leave us, and he's walking with Elisha. I always thought it was interesting as a psychologist. I always thought, why are they walking? Why are they walking? And I came up with two reasons. One is they're progressing. They're moving together. There was no stagnation. It's a symbol that it goes on. But I think more powerfully and perhaps more practically and pragmatically, if this was the last time I was ever going to see my Rebbe, I don't know that I could look him in the face. When you're walking with somebody, you don't have to look in their face. Eliyahu leaves and Elisha goes, Avi, Avi, cries out, my father, come back. Says the Rav, that is the textual reason. He says a more powerful reason. He says you can fool anybody in this world. You put on an act. You can be a phony. You can be a fake. The two people you can't fool, your wife and your children, or your husband and your children. So know who you really, really are. It's called Pirkei Avos because these people practice what they preach, and they preach what they practice. They were real human beings, and we're supposed to take our lesson from them. And I told the story in the last session about auditioning somebody and an actor who knew all these characters. And I ended up by asking the question, do we know about ourselves what makes us happy and sad and act and react and all those other things I mentioned before? Can we honestly look at our mate, the person that we are bound with for life eternal, and say, I know what makes them happy and what makes them sad and what makes them walk and what makes them talk and act and react and think. And all too often in this world of economic pressure and in this world of raising children, which is an extremely time-consuming and energy-draining event, sometimes we husband and wives, get put on the back burner. And the minute we get put on the back burner, we're undermining our ability to healthily carry on all those other things that we're doing. So it requires a little bit of scrutiny. It requires a little bit of honesty. It requires a little bit of rejuvenation. It requires a little bit of, like, every 3 months going out to dinner together and doing a mental health checkup on your own relationship to give it a head kick start. And maybe we get in the babysitter one night and just going off and dancing the lights fantastic away in the city just to bring those old days back. It's wonderful, because the person that you married is the person that you love, and the person that you marry is the person that you're going to be continuing to bring a next generation into our people. We're a very small people. The numbers are unbelievable. In the United States of America, in yeshiva high schools, in the United States of America, grades 9 through 12, I'm not talking about little yeshivas in Brooklyn, in regular out-of-crown type schools, you're looking at about 18,000 high school kids. That's it. We're a preciously small people. And if we don't start taking care of each other, and it starts with a family, it starts with husband and wife, the essence of the family, nobody's going to do it for us. I'll be around later to answer questions. I realize I didn't get to the whole thing, and have an absolutely happy Thanksgiving Day, everybody.
Okay. I want to thank once again Dr. Johnny Krug. Everybody's invited. Come get some lunch and join us very quickly for the panel discussions to hear Rabbi Kenneth Brander, who will lead the discussion along with Dr. John Krug, as well as Dr. Norman Blumenthal. So join us back in the main shul once again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.